Alrighty, welcome to another episode of Constructed Resources. This is Constructed Resources 39, Advanced Maneuvers for Advanced Players. I'm Louis Scott Vargas here with another advanced player, Andrew Beckstrom. BK, how's it going?
You know, it's pretty good. I'm coming off of a big win, my biggest win in Magic this year, probably. We had the showdown last weekend with the Lords of Limited. And let's just say that neither you nor I lost a match.
Oh, yeah. In fact, we even played the last round when the conclusion was already foregone. And we both emerged with a 3-0 victory. You know, little aggro bros here. I went Silver Quill after saying I hadn't really drafted much on the latest LR. In fact, that was my first time drafting Silver Quill. But you know what? It's kind of like riding a bike. Once you're really acquainted with the beatdown life, you don't really need much practice. And then you drafted Lorehold Aggro, and I think it's fair to say we trounced them. So we're up 2-1 in the series, but you know what? I'm expecting a lot more, and maybe we'll even it up next time.
You know, that is the classic analogy for doing something well the first time. It's like riding a bike. You know, I mean, I'm obviously happy that we won. It's awesome to win. Like, for me, though, you know, I'm not in the Rivals League, and I'm not one of the best Magic players of all time, like you have yourself admitted. So I'm glad to hear you enjoying it, too, though.
I don't think admitted is the right word, more as confidently asserted, but yes. And you know what? Speaking of confidently assertions, this show is brought to you by ChannelFireball.com. And you can check out ChannelFireball.com for a lot of awesome content. CFP Pro has been a real boon to long-form content. One of the things that I really like about it is it lets me do these deep dives. In fact, I've done a deep dive on Strixhaven Sealed that's coming out on Tuesday. And so I guess that's in a couple days here. That's the 4th of May. And it's going to really just give you everything you need to know about Strixhaven Sealed in time for the Arena Open, which is on the 8th. So check out CFP Pro at channelfireball.com/pro. And if you end up signing up, use the code CR. Show the podcast a little love.
Good stuff. All right. Before we get to our main topic, I got some decks of the week, and this is an all Primeval Titan week. I've got two Primeval Titan decks picked out to just get people up to speed on what's going on with that card. You know, obviously one of the mainstays of the modern format. There's always a good Primeval Titan deck rolling around. And right now, first off, let's talk about Red-Green Valakut. And so this is sort of just the classic idea of, you know, we're trying to ramp out. We're actually playing a ton of mountains in our deck so that we can actually just naturally turn on Valakut at the Molten Pinnacle in longer games where we can actually get six mountains into play. But what it's doing is it's taking advantage of Dwarven Mine and the fact that that is a mountain which can produce a 1/1 dwarf and you can fetch it out. This is part of the Mystic Sanctuary cycle from Eldraine. And what it does is it combines in Dwarven Mind with something like Indomitable Creativity or Transmogrify, and that way you get to just put out a Primeval Titan. And obviously what you're probably thinking is, hey, why am I playing with Primeval Titan in this deck instead of something like Emrakul, where, you know, because we are playing with 3 Indomitable Creativities and 4 Transmogrifies. But the big deal is that Primeval Titan is just a card you can naturally cast, and it really matters when you accidentally draw your target for your Transmogrify style effect, that you actually can just use it immediately, or that you can actually cast it relatively, is what I'm trying to say. And the other big thing going on with Primeval Titan is that in a lot of ways it's better than Emrakul just because it does provide a real immediate effect. And there are just removal spells in Modern that can actually get an Emrakul off the board if it just has to sit and turn and play before attacking. So otherwise, though, it's exactly what you'd expect. We've got Lightning Bolts, Explorers, Far Seeks, and Search for Tomorrows, and we can just use that to ramp out our Primeval Titans or just ramp out to enough mountains to fetch for a Dwarven Mine. So sort of the new hot way to play just a straight Valakut deck in Modern is to combine Dwarven Mine with Transmogrifier and Indomitable Creativity.
The thing that stands out most to me about this is that Dwarven Mine is basically free. You have to play 4 copies of Dwarven Mind, which, sure, sometimes you'll draw it and it'll be like a little awkward. But with all your red fetches, you know, 12 red fetches here, you basically just have Dwarven Mind whenever you want it. And yeah, that means that you Transmogrify and Nominal Creativity just basically become 4 mana tutor for a creature. I guess the biggest cost is you can't play any other creatures, so just like you can't put Sakura Tribe Elder in your deck. But right. That seems like a pretty reasonable cost to pay to get a bunch of 4-mana Primeval Titans.
Yep, and this deck is also playing with Fire Prophecy, so you've got a little more flexibility. And you know, one of the nice things about Fire Prophecy is that it helps smooth things out for a deck which is, you know, obviously focused on getting to enough land so that you cast Primeval Titan, doesn't want to draw too many Indomitable Creativities or Transmogrifies in a game. That'll be a little bit awkward for it. Next up, I wanted to talk about the deck that Gabriel Nassif took to top 8 in the Modern Challenge on Saturday, and then it got second on Sunday. And we're talking another version of a Valakut deck, but this one is built around Scapeshift. This is a Bring to Light Scapeshift deck, and it's 4 colors, and it starts off its acceleration with the combination of Elvish Reclaimer and Flagstones of Chorkir, which is, you know, a combination we've talked about in the past, but, you know, Elvish Reclaimer is that 1-mana elf. Flagstones of Chorkir is a white legendary land that when it goes to your graveyard, you get to search your library for a plains and put it into play. And so if you sacrifice it to Elvish Reclaimer, you both get the land from the Elvish Reclaimer activation, but you also get a plains from your deck. And because of Ketria Triome, we now have, and like things like Savoy Triome, we now have a much more much stronger tapped plains that we can find from our deck with something like Flagstones or Chorkir. And then ultimately, we're getting up to Bring to Light, so we can Bring to Light for Escape Shift. But there's some pretty great targets, obviously, besides that, just things like Supreme Verdict, Omnath, if you need to stabilize and just get like a good mid-range card. So a pretty linear and focused deck, nonetheless, but one that has a lot more ability to sort of get a powerful ramp engine with those 2-for-1 effect of Elvish Reclaimer. And then you do have the occasional silver bullet land at 2 or 4, like a Bazooka Bog against all these people playing Thrilling Discovery Dredge.
This deck is sweet. The only thing I don't like about this deck is that earlier versions played more Cleansing Wildfires, and this one has reduced it to just 1. So you don't get to live the dream against Tron where you Cleansing Wildfire them 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, you got it. And that's part of that is like figuring out sort of what your curve is going to look like and what you're planning on. With 4 copies of Explore and 4 copies of Elvish Reclaimer, this deck doesn't necessarily have the space on turn 2 to be able to cast a Cleansing Wildfire. Once we get to turn 3, we're looking, the curve here is Dryad Elysian Grove and Teferi Time Reveler. Dryad is obviously fantastic because this is sort of how you can make Valakut work when you don't scapeshift, and it allows it so that, you know, your scapeshifts can just work when you just draw 6 lands. Or sorry, your Valakuts can work when you just draw 6 lands. And that's one of the other nice perks about Elvish Reclaimer is that it's one of the better land tutors in the format. So a draw of Elvish Reclaimer and Dryad Elysian Grove can quickly assemble an online Valakut or 2 without much additional work from your deck.
Elvish Reclaimer is a cool card. It's the kind of card that didn't do a single thing in Standard. Is it still legal in Standard? I don't even know.
No, it's gone now.
But in Modern and also in Legacy, this card is seeing play. In Legacy, you've got the decks that are like green-white fetching out a bunch of like Wastelands and Caracas and whatnot. And then there's like the green-black decks getting Thespian Stage Dark Depths off it. So cool card. I always like it when they can kind of slip those cards in that don't really impact Standard but impact older formats. And Elvish Reclaimer certainly does.
Oh, and then the last thing definitely should just throw out that, of course, this deck is a Bring to Light deck, and Modern is playing with a copy of Valky, God of Lies, just because that combination with Tybalt is fantastic. Had a fun moment, though, because this deck also has the Madcap Experiment Platinum Empyrean combo in the sideboard, and we were talking to Josh McLean, he was like, yeah, and sometimes you just don't side in the Platinum Empyrean, you side in the Madcap Experiment and you're like, Damping Sphere, and it's an extra copy of that, and me and Sam were just looking at Josh like, what are you talking about? And he was like, what do you mean? I was like, you can't do that. He's like, why not? I was like, you'll kill yourself. And in a typical Josh McLean fashion, he just kind of played fast and loose and had never gotten burned by it. But yeah, Madcap Experiment will deal you a lot of damage, and there's a reason why you combine it with Platinum Empyrean, because if you combine it with treating any other artifact into play, you risk just killing yourself on the spot with that effect.
All right, so we got some sweet decks of the week here, but I'm excited about our main topic because as extremely advanced players ourselves, me and BK have a real good insight into what these kind of like special moves are. And it's funny because going against conventional wisdom can always be a little tricky. conventional wisdom is, well, it's conventional for a reason. It's because it's usually right. Heuristics kind of work that way, where you generally want to do the most of the things that you know, kind of these patterns have taught us. Like, well, you know, if you look at some of the examples, like not keeping one landers, playing your land on turn four, like things that seem pretty obvious, but there's some pretty good edge to be gained when you actually go against kind of what you would normally do. And there are times to break from these molds. So why don't we get started with the first one, which is sideboarding out a land. And tell us a little bit about what situations you might find yourself in when you want to sideboard out a land.
Yeah, I mean, I think first off, the biggest one that's going to come up when you want to sideboard out a land is just a game where is sort of, it's more defined by the characteristics of a situation. It's not like it's clearly advantageous for you to sideboard out a land. Typically, you're not even going to want to sideboard out a land just because of the fact is that when a land will allow you to cast your best spells, it just, that's what it's good for. And when you sideboard out a land, what you're essentially saying is you're saying, I would like to reduce my chances of being able to successfully cast a card. But the upside of that is that I get to fit more spells in my deck. And, you know, if you have a tutor, if you have tutoring effects, or even just, you know, you just want to have the ability to just be able to play more spells in a game on average, well, then you're saying sideboarding out a land could be worth it. So first off, one of the biggest things you're going to be looking for is just like, are all of your cards actually good in the matchup? Because if they're not all good, well, then you don't want to do that. The next big thing you want to do is figure out that your curve was probably set up to have a certain number of lands for a reason. You know, you're playing with a bunch of six drops in your deck and you are playing, you know, 26 lands, and that makes sense. So first off, is there something with your post-board configuration which has a different set of mana requirements than your pre-board configuration? And so if you're playing a control deck where you have some, you know, grindy six mana planeswalker, maybe something like a Professor Onyx, and you have decided that they're too slow for the matchup, you might decide that, hey, you know what? Given that my curve has been reduced substantially, I sat in a bunch of one and two mana removal, it might make sense that you are now concerned that if you keep that similar amount of lands, you might run into the case where now you're going to flood out because you don't have the kind of card draw and long game power in your deck. You just have a bunch of cheap removal.
Well, one situation where this came up recently for us was when me and my team played Gruul in one of the league weekends. And in the mirror, we were boarding in Fire Prophecies, Soul Seers, and a Crone Wars. And we were boarding out like Brush Fire Elementals because they died to Stomp off a Bone Crusher Giant and all these other removal spells. And our sideboard plan actually just straight up written down was boarding out a land in the Gruul mirror, play or draw. And the reason was, well, first of all, the Gruul deck in Standard plays Shatter Skull Smashing and Kazandu Mammoth, so it's already on like 29 lands or 30 lands, which means it's obviously much less risky. Yeah, sometimes you got to play a Mammoth or a Smashing as a land when you wouldn't want to otherwise, but you're not actually going to miss your third land drop. The other is, when both players have tons of removal spells, because most people were on a similar plan, right? You look at these Gruul sideboards from that era of Standard, which is just like the last set, like 2 months ago or something. Yeah, most people had like between 3 and 5 removal spells in the sideboard plus some Crone Wars. The games just weren't races anymore. It was both players killing each other's stuff and trying to find an opening to land a Great Henge or stick up, you know, a Vivian or something like that. So in that case, the way the games played out, the games were pretty long. The Gruul decks weren't really known for their card draw, you know, prowess. And as a result, we thought it was actually pretty good to board out a land. And this is a team of, you know, good, even if somewhat washed up players. So we had figured out that boarding out a land made a lot of sense when the matchups got slower and everyone had more removal. It wasn't doomed to miss your fourth land drop if you had a Soul Seer and like a Fire Prophecy in hand. It just wasn't that big of a deal.
Yeah, so you weren't actually even like necessarily losing expensive cards, but if you are siding out Brushfire Elemental and saying, I'm going to play Kazandu Mammoth more often as a land, you're almost sort of reducing how much your deck wants to have hit land drops just because of that alone.
Yeah, and you would be fine, again, like maybe stalling on one of your lands. If you were just killing one of their things every single turn, you would buy yourself time to draw out those lands. And most games of Standard, for example, and actually most constructed games in every format, aren't really attrition battles. How many times do you find yourself losing a game because you ran out of things to do? Because Magic cards aren't really made that way anymore, and certainly not in the older formats, but even in Standard, you lose because they do a more powerful thing. Well, when both players have access to 2 and 3 mana spells that can kill the opposing 3 and 4 mana plays, it becomes less about who does a more powerful thing first and just who has more cards at the end of the game. And one way to do that is, well, to draw more spells and fewer lands.
Another common example of when you'll sometimes consider sideboarding out a land is when you have utility lands, which either don't tap for mana, though that's not common in modern day Magic.
Yeah, really bad example.
Or they tap for mana and they provide some additional effect. A good example would be something like Field of Ruin, but then you go and you play against a deck which has nothing but basics, and that's not the most common, but it does come up every once in a while. And in that scenario where, you know, all of a sudden your Field of Ruin is basically offline, this came up in the Standard format when people were playing with like the Hazoret decks before. I guess they always had Ramunap Ruins. Maybe it wasn't exactly that mono red deck, but there was a mono red deck around that time when Field of Ruin was still legal where this came up occasionally, where I would just side out Field of Ruins because it was just like they weren't doing anything for me in the matchup and they weren't tapping for colors. I couldn't even rely on using Field of Ruin for fixing because you literally can't activate Field of Ruin. And in that scenario, because I was also dropping my curve, it made sense for me to side out some Field of Ruins.
Yeah, and one of the advantages of playing these like Bojuka Bog or Field of Ruin or whatever these lands are that, you know, Ghost Quarter that add a little bit of value is that you kind of get to play above your normal land count and not really get punished for it because they're also like spell-like effects. Well, when the spell-like effects aren't good, yeah, you can definitely side them out. What do you think about the theory that sometimes you should side out a land because you got flooded in the previous game?
I mean, I've certainly been in situations where I have decided I'm not playing the appropriate number of lands in the middle of the tournament. Usually it's that I decided I was playing too few lands. It was more common. But I try not to let how the previous game go influence me too much.
I mean, I got to say, if you want to look at the last league weekend where my team submitted the Sultai Ultimatum deck in Historic, and I kind of described it on the show already, but we submitted it kind of last minute where it was just like the 11th hour, like, hey, we're going to switch to this deck. 2 hours after decks had been submitted and they were completely locked, we came to the kind of like sickening realization that we just needed like 2 more lands in the deck. And it ended up fine. The deck was still really well positioned for the weekend. We had a great record. I went 6-0. Definitely no regrets there. But there was that period of time before the tournament started, and it's just like, I would kill to just get to put another land into the deck. And, you know, you played it a little that weekend, and it was just like, how are you playing this on 26 lands?
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because I, you know, Growth Spiral has been such a major part while it was legal and Standard that it's like, no stranger to the experience of, do I really need to play the 27th land or whatever it was? And then every time you try to cheat the devil with Growth Spiral, you really do get burned. And I'm sure you felt that a couple of times in the tournament.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I and also the way it works psychologically is I know that adding a 27th land is not going to like drastically change the percentages. But in my very first game with the deck, I missed my third land drop and I was just like, I should have played another land.
Right. Yeah. It's like, I don't, whatever. If you added 2 more lands and it's like it reduces like by like, you know, 40 or 50% the number of draws that would have been messed up by that, it's you still would have experienced it the other half of the time, even if you had added those lands. So not because you still can flood, of course, in Magic. All right. So next up in terms of special maneuvers, you know, what are the things that we would generally advise you not to, but you know, every once in a while, if you're an advanced player, you might want to consider doing it. How about taking the draw? And you know, this is a relatively more common thing in Limited, Luis, but have you ever taken the draw in Constructed?
I literally chose to draw first 2 league weekends ago in a high stakes match, in fact, multiple times. Can you guess what?
This was not the most recent league weekend?
It was not.
Oh, man. Well, if you tell me what your decks were, I could probably guess.
I was playing mono red in Standard.
Oh, you were playing the mono red mirror, probably.
Exactly. And so I think I told someone today when I was talking to them that, yes, you can choose whether to play or draw in Magic, but above 99% of the time you choose to play first. Do you think that's fairly accurate?
Yeah. Oh, but yes, it feels like we should be saying, I want to say it's less than that, but in reality, it is so infrequent, and it's just such a special, cool moment when you decide, ooh, it might be good to take the draw here. And, you know, one of the things that you're always attracted, one of the things that's fun about playing a game like Magic is just like you get this feeling of getting to outwit your opponent. And so anytime you get to do something like that is so loudly, like a bunch of the decisions we're going to be talking about today are ones where it's sort of secret. It's just between you and yourself that you did this fancy thing. When you choose to take the draw, you are saying to your opponent, I believe that my understanding of the matchup is different than yours, and that it is better for me if I'm on the draw. And I am declaring right now that you are wrong and I'm right. I'm smart. You're dumb. Like, not to that degree of aggressiveness, but that is kind of what you're doing.
No, to that degree of aggressiveness, actually. I've thought about asking my opponents after I chose to draw game two and they choose to play game three, like, do you think you're better than me? Do you think you understand this better than me? Because
no, you're one of the best players of all time.
Well, actually, I do have a funny story in that vein. It was Rise of Eldrazi Limited, and I played against Frank Karsten, and he didn't test for the tournament at all. And he wins game one, and I choose to draw, and then I win game two. And game three, he's like, well, you know, I haven't played this format at all, and you've tested a lot. I'm just going to choose to draw since you seem to think it was right. And that's typical Karsten. Like, he is very analytic. But
Well, I mean, that happened in the Seth Sam Black matchup, too. We could talk about that at some point.
What happened?
This was in the World Championships where Seth was playing Abzan and Sam was playing Mono White Midrange. This was like Khans of Tarkir era standard.
Oh, I did coverage of that tournament, yeah.
And Sam Black was playing a Knight of the White Orchid deck, and Knight of the White Orchid's that white-white two-drop.
Right.
That when you play it, if your opponent has more lands than you, you play a Plains from your deck tapped. And so Sam Black was sort of getting the edge by like being able to plan on his Knight of the... He wanted his Knight of the White Orchids to work because he wanted to try to like actually sort of out attrition the Abzan deck, and it would sort of work better and he would be able to rely on his knights. And then I think at one point in the best of five set, Seth, when he had the choice, just takes the draw, because now not only does it like mean that if Sam is right, then that Seth will gain back the edge, but also because Sam Black was playing with Knight of the White Orchids in his deck, which he would have, he might not have all of the copies when he was on the play, if he was going to be on the play in a spot. It meant that Sam Black couldn't rely upon knowing whether he was play or draw.
Oh yeah, that is very clever. And you know, to go back to the mono red matchup, I chose to draw because, again, like the Gruul matchup in the mono red mirror, both players are bringing like 2 to 4 red cap melee, just have tons of removal, and the game's not about speed; it's about who can just have more cards. So, being on the draw is. There's a couple reasons to do it. One is, and the most important is, you've got a lot of cheap removal and you can equalize the tempo advantage. You know, this happens way more commonly in limited because constructed, just like the decks are so powerful, you should basically always be on the play. Very rarely should you not. But in limited, like, if you, like, for example, using this format, if you have, you know, you're playing Witherbloom, black green, and you have double Lash of Malice and you have a couple good two drops, like, you're not an aggressive deck, like, you should consider choosing to draw if you're ever in a situation where you get the choice, because you can.
We're recording constructed resources right now, by the way.
I'm aware, but I'm explaining this that's useful for people who play both constructed and limited. And then in constructed, the mono red mirror is a good example. There have been some control mirrors where you choose to draw. That's a lot less frequent these days because there's just so many impactful cards you're trying to get to. But you know what? Planeswalkers haven't really been a big feature of constructed recently, so maybe it's not crazy to consider it in some of these like more controlling matchups. But in general, the reason to be on the draw is if you have cheap answers to their cards, you can negate the fact that they were on the play and then end up being up a card. And it's not something you should do often, but man, when you do it, it does feel good.
Yeah, I mean, and if we just talk on most basic level, like, what is the advantage to being on the draw? Well, the advantage to being on the draw is that when you take each of your turns, you will have seen one fewer card than me if you're on the play. You start the game with 7, I basically start the game with 8. The disadvantage, of course, is that I get to sort of get access to my mana later than you. You have 1 mana before I have 1, you have 2 mana before I have 2. And so the big thing is just how much is that mana advantage going to matter? And so that is the sort of the most critical aspect about why being on the draw is good, is that if it's not about who is spending their mana the most efficiently on the first couple turns of the game, because in the case of the Gruul matchup, like your mirror or the mono red mirror where you're mentioning, where everyone's cards are trading with each other so efficiently, or in the case of the control mirror where there's such a disadvantage to playing anything because it allows your opponent to potentially counter and untap and do something really strong on their turn. Well, in that case, since mana isn't being spent, it means that essentially having access to more cards, you can make your land drops more consistently, you can have the key card at the right time more often. That is the kinds of things that's going to make it better. In general, though, taking the draw is extremely risky because you can't rely upon your opponent's sideboard plans always lining up exactly the way that you want, or that the game of Magic is going to work exactly the way that you want. And the fact is that sometimes you can make up for the fact that your draw was a little bit awkward, that you stumbled coming out of the gates, just by the fact that your opponent was on the back foot, that you were able to present a threat and force them to have something first. And so you don't want to necessarily give up that advantage just for the sort of more theoretical abstract advantage that we're describing in terms of having access to sort of one more card than your opponent.
A good way to describe it, I think, is it is rarely going to be a mistake to choose to play first. And if it is, it's not a very big mistake. Whereas right. choosing to draw first could be a much bigger mistake, because so much evidence is weighted towards being on the play that you have to be pretty sure that you want to be on the draw. And we both have been, you know, convinced of this in various matchups. Like I said, I did it not too long ago. But the burden of proof is definitely on being on the draw rather than being on the play. But you know what? Like I said, every tip here is going to be something you don't do very often. But knowing when to do it and having opportunities to do it can make you a more well-rounded Magic player.
Yeah, and it generally has felt like it has not been as useful with some, you know, as Magic design has evolved and we've sort of been making it a little bit more forgiving on people in terms of, you know, mulliganing and giving you lots of things to do with your mana, with like your activated abilities on lands. It has been harder for you to be in a, like the cycling triumphs, for instance. It has been much harder for it to emerge that, not, or rather, it's much harder for just basically getting the extra mana to not be worth it. Like that is just point blank, like the big thing is like, you could just always do things with your mana. You should want to have more mana than your opponent. There's a reason why Growth Spiral was like the most dominant card in Standard for 2 years, is because it gave you such a low opportunity cost way to have more mana than your opponent. It's because there's lots of great ways to use your mana in Magic nowadays. So if we're going to give it up, it will be times when it's right, but you know, make sure you understand why and what sort of things to look out for when figuring that out.
All right. So we've also got, this is a nice one. This is something I've done a couple times only, but when it comes up, it's very sweet. This is missing a land drop on purpose.
Yeah, this is, this is everything from missing a land drop on purpose to like, whether when we're talking about like, I'm not going to play my fourth land on turn four, to everything from like, I'm going to sandbag an extra land in hand so that my last land in hand, so that my opponent doesn't know what's going on. And the next thing you do, you draw like some kind of card draw effect, which means all of a sudden you have two lands and you would have a way to spend all of your mana if you could do it. You know, a common example, and this isn't technically like missing your land drop, is I've been in spots where I have not cracked Fabled Passage in a game a couple of times just because, and in the early parts of the game, because I was so far behind in knowing what colors I needed. And if I didn't draw a land, it really wasn't going to matter. And so I might as well play the Fabled Passage, but I'm going to need to top deck a land. But until I top deck that land, I need to know what color that land gives me so I know what to go with my Fabled Passage. And I'm setting myself back from maybe potentially having the absolute perfect draw, but I'm sort of mitigating that by ensuring that it's more likely I actually have all of my colors taken care of.
My favorite example of not playing a land was in a sealed tournament. This is GP Bochum many, many years ago, where Mirror were in the format. And what Mirror are 2-mana 1/1s that tap for a color of mana. So I played a turn 2 Mirror, and my opponent thought for a second about killing it, decided not to, played their third land and passed. On my turn, I hit them for one, they took it, and I just didn't play a land and passed. My hand at the time was like 3 more lands and 2 removal spells, and I really wanted them to use their kill spell on my 1/1. They then shattered it. This is, again, sealed. wait, is this constructed or limited resources? I want to make sure I know. And I ended up winning in a long attrition game because I just didn't play my third land on turn three in a hand where I didn't really need it, and I really wanted them to kill my mana dork. That's going to be pretty rare, but the situation you mentioned is going to be much more common, as are the situations where you like try to play around like mind rot effects and you know, any sort of discard by having extra lands in hand or concealing information. Though I believe you at your guys' place have a committee where you have to justify not playing a land. Is that how it works?
Yeah. We have a joke that you need to have a license in order to miss a land drop to sandbag a land, because you basically, it's something that only the most elite players should ever get to do. And when you foul it, your license can get revoked, and then you don't have the license to miss land drops on purpose. Because we've all seen it foul people more often than not. I mean, the reality is that if your opponent is semi-competent and you're just like not doing anything and you consistently just have one card in hand for a couple of turns, and then all of a sudden it's like you top deck a spell and you play it, and it's like, and then you pass back to your opponent with still one card in hand, it's like they know, and that you just have a land in hand, and no amount of how tricky you think you're being with that play is really going to change that.
How often do you think you've not played a land on purpose before like turn six?
I mean,
turn six is kind of arbitrary, but I'm just curious.
I don't know. It's got to be like less than 1% of the time. It's just so uncommon that it's the right thing to do. I mean, sometimes the most important thing is that you know what your deck's capable of, because not every deck is the most obvious scenario where I'm not going to play my sixth land is that, like I mentioned before, is that you draw some kind of like draw two effect, and one of the cards is a land and the other card is like an expensive spell, and you would have had the mana to be able to play the expensive spell if you had played the land the previous turn and still had a land drop then available for the new land. And not every deck can do that, but more decks can kind of backdoor into that situation in ways than you would expect. And so if you ever get it wrong, you were just opening, you're just giving yourself a percentage chance of getting punished. And all we're frequently doing in these games is just trying to increase our percentages of things going right. And when you're opening up the percentage, you know, you talk a lot about, Luis, about the reason why people think you get lucky is that you put yourself in a position to get lucky. Holding on to lands is putting yourself in a position to get unlucky.
So what's the takeaway that we put this point down for?
I think the takeaway is that if you're going to do it, make sure it actually has real strategic value in terms of what you are bluffing, and that you are actually gaining something, either because your land has an important decision associated with it. A pathway or a fabled passage will sometimes give you, if you are trying to do something like hit an ultimatum, sometimes it's not common that you're going to want to do that for an ultimatum because you're going to want to exactly hit your cards on curve. But if you have a similar situation where you have, you know, you're two lands away and from hitting some card with intense mana requirements, and you have like a blue-red pathway in hand, so you have like a Niv-Mizzet, Perun, and then you need to decide, you know, is it that important that you play Niv-Mizzet the turn that you hit the sixth land, or is it more important in your deck with maybe relatively poor mana otherwise that in case you draw an island or a mountain, you have the right thing on your pathway? And so if you're going to do it, make sure you are doing it for an actual real benefit, not just something, it seems like it might be worth it. And if you are not confident about what your deck is capable of, just make sure you play the land out.
Well, like all these tips, mostly you shouldn't do these, but in the high leverage spots, sometimes they can give you a bit of additional value. This one's good. Setting strategic stops on Arena. So if you've played Arena, and you know, if you've been playing Magic this year, kind of hard to avoid it. Arena will auto-pass you if you have nothing you can do. So if you play a turn on Mountain and then pass the turn, it won't auto-pass you through your turn. You also have to hit okay at least once in your turn. But if you have a Mountain untapped and you do not have a shock or anything you can cast, it'll just auto-pass through their turn. But if you do have a shock, it'll start giving you priority every time they try to leave a phase or play anything. So, like, for example, if you're playing in Standard and your mono-red opponent plays a Mountain and says go, and you play an Innkeeper and then they get priority, well, you're about to find out that they have a Frostbite. But for the most part, you can tell, especially when they're on low mana counts, kind of what your opponents have or don't have by virtue of Autopasser. So what you can't ever do is you can't fake not having it, because if you have it, you'll get priority. There's no way to go about it. Even if you hit the like auto pass priority till end of turn, it still gives you priority. It's not very reliable. Unless there's like an F6 kind of function that I'm not aware of. For the most part, you always have priority.
Oh, do you wish there was?
Yeah. But what you can do to obfuscate this, and KG Arena players will do this, not on the ladder usually because it's just not worth it, but in high stakes tournaments, you're playing in like, you know, an SCG 5K, or you're playing in a Mythic Invitational qualifier, what have you. You just either go into full control or set stops on all their stops. And that way it looks like you've got Shock or Stomp or Mystical Dispute. And like that's a good one, because that one's actually kind of hard to fake, because you won't get priority until there's a spell on the stack, in which case you will get priority. But by setting those stops, you can fake having cards you don't have. Or at the very least, once you've done it enough, your opponent will realize that you're setting stops on everything, but then they can't rule out cards. Whereas getting auto-passed will rule out a card. If you get auto-passed with two mountains up, you don't have Stomp. Like, you just know that for a fact. So a way to get around that is to set more stops. And I actually think that the dominant strategy isn't to just always set stops. It's just to vary your range, to balance your range where sometimes you set stops and sometimes you don't, to basically make it so they have a hard time guessing, while also potentially luring them into doing something, because, oh, you didn't set a stop before, so they know you don't have it, and then you set a stop now, and all of a sudden they may convince themselves that you don't have something, or you do have something. Like, if, for example, if you didn't set a stop for a while and then you did, that would actually convince them you had it, because you weren't setting a stop before. So you can actually bluff more effectively by not always setting a stop, but the minimum information given is to always have stops everywhere in order to make it so you always get priority, they always think you have whatever it could be. The biggest downside is it's a real pain. Like, you would have to just, you know, do a lot of clicking and say okay a lot. So this is a reason you don't run into it in ladder much, but I actually think it gives you meaningful win percentage. And as much as I'm lazy when it comes to stuff like this, when I'm playing the league weekends for high stakes, yeah, I put stops on my opponent's turns so that they just, like, you don't want them ruling out cards, because they might just play an Edgewall Innkeeper they wouldn't have played otherwise if they don't think you have Stomp.
I mean, it is like kind of just too backbreaking when people are playing with like the ultimatum cycle, and it's just like, for your opponent to just know that you don't have Mystical Dispute can just be an absolute game-ending thing. And it came up a lot in Standard when Wilderness Reclamation was the big thing going on. Just, you know, end of turn Growth Spiral, oh, you don't have Mystical Dispute, all right, let's go. I'm playing my Wilderness Reclamation and getting a huge advantage from that. So you just, it's one of those things where you don't want to be spending, obviously, too much of your time and attention. You know, one of the things I always like to describe to people is like, is your goal to win more matches this weekend or to win more matches this year or next year? Because if your goal is to win more matches next year, well, spending a ton of time going deep on setting stops doesn't really help you with that, because it's just not nearly as fundamental to winning games of Magic as having a good understanding of the fundamentals of the game and what is going to take it's going to take to be able to win matches against other high level players. But if you really want to do like try to maximize your chances for this weekend, making sure you are not giving away extra information on your stops or when there's a lack of pause is a big thing. And likewise, just sort of being able to quickly deduce what it means when there's a pause in a game and being aware of what the false tells are, so to speak. Like, you know, we keep coming back to limited, but it's like, oh, my opponent has something. It's like, oh, no, wait. They just have one of the campus. That's the new Scrylands in the new limited set. And it's like, well, when they have those in play and four mana up, you just can't know anything. It's just going to always give them a pause whenever you take an action.
In Constructed, this comes up the most with Fabled Passage. Yeah. And it's actually, funnily enough, we talked about missing land drops. A reason to not crack Fabled Passage can be that it gives you priority always, which sometimes is actually good, because you don't, even when you're setting all the stops, sometimes you can like slip and not set a stop at a certain time, or it's just very aggravating to always have to set them. Sometimes it's right to keep out Fabled Passage, and it's got the additional benefit as it conceals every card in your hand. And look, again, as much as this is the sort of thing that I usually wouldn't bother with, this actually matters. Like BK said, it actually matters knowing whether you have Mystical Dispute or not, or if you can narrow down that, oh, wow, they don't have a Heartless Act in their hand. Okay, well, that's definitely going to change how I play. And it's the sort of thing that can really decide games. So learning the whole stops and setup and like what to bluff and when not to, it will increase your win percentage. This might be the most directly applicable or most commonly applicable trick on this entire list, because it's the thing that most people just don't do and really can impact your win percentage.
Next up, I want to talk a little bit about when it's right to just sort of get rid of your own stuff. We're talking about killing your own stuff. And this is a play which comes up from time to time. It particularly comes up in older formats where the spells are a little bit less, more likely to fizzle. We're just talking about the idea of like killing your own stuff. And, you know, the most common example, I guess, right now in Standard is the example of the adventure creatures. When you're playing against Bone Crusher Giant or Brazen Borrower and your opponent tries to, you know, bounce something or deal 2 damage to it, if you just have some kind of removal spell burning a hole in your pocket, you could, you know, but maybe it doesn't work on that creature. Like, say you have a shock, you could just shock your own Edgewall Innkeeper, for instance, or Spikefield Hazard it, and now they're not going to get the Bone Crusher Giant as their stomp is fizzled by your target no longer being there when the spell goes to resolve.
It's not a play you make very often, but it's definitely good to have in your wheelhouse because, you know, the way magic works, spells need to resolve, and if they're all their, to have all their effects, and if all their targeted all the targets for them are gone, they won't happen. This can come up with Cryptic Command, where if you choose the, you know, like bounce something, tap your whole team mode. Well, removing the thing that's getting targeted by the bounce does fizzle the tap your whole team mode. Oh, actually, tap your whole team. Yeah, it's all your creature's opponent's control. Yeah, that is one that does fizzle. Yeah. I will say, to give R&D credit, is they're very aware of how this works, and most spells with different modes now offer some targeting stuff that seems kind of unintuitive why you would have that there, like Lorehold Command, for example. It deals 3 to any target, and target player gains 3 life, and that's so that you can choose that mode and choose the mode of like make a 3/2, and then if they remove their target, the target of gaining 3 life still means that the whole spell kind of resolves still. But there's plenty of spells, like you mentioned, that don't work that way.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this and maybe you're a little confused because maybe, you know, you haven't played much paper and you haven't had to negotiate these role situations, it's pretty simple. It's just, If a spell mentions a target, and when the spell goes to resolve, all of the targets are no longer in play or no longer valid, you know, something that was, you know, needed to hit something with 4 power or more, and now the thing only has 3 power, got shrunk somehow. But basically the idea is that if all of the targets are no longer valid, then the spell or the ability, this applies to, you know, abilities too, will just be countered. And so when we talk about something like Cryptic Command was a weird one, right? Cryptic Command has some modes which target and some don't. Draw a card doesn't target. Counter target spell does. If you were to like remand your own spell back to your hand, then the Cryptic Command goes and sees, I don't have anything to counter. All of my targets have been removed. I'm just going to get countered, the whole thing. You don't even get to draw the card. But like you mentioned, Louise, great point. They figured that out. All of the commands now, either none of the modes target or they all target. And so basically, it's impossible to fizzle them no matter which combination you choose because, you know, they can kind of get away with having one mode that doesn't target as long as the other ones are, like, super reliable. But yeah, basically, you see all sorts of wonkiness in terms of how these cards are templated nowadays. But it's just to make things a little bit easier for players. But nonetheless, you know, Electrolyze just got put into the historic card pool. That's an example of one where sometimes you'll be able to fizzle an Electrolyze by just removing your own creature. That's the deal. 2 divided spell, draw a card. And so it's worth noting is that sometimes when you play against these, it's going to come up the most commonly against creatureless decks. And it's just a really good thing to keep in mind is that this is a way that you can actually trade your removal for a card. You're not necessarily doing so in a super efficient way, but you're actually getting value out of your removal spell in a matchup where you might not otherwise get any.
I think the most common place this is going to come up is adventure creatures. And it happens all the time when you're playing like a red deck against another red deck and they go to stomp your creature. stomping your own creature in response is an advantageous play at that point, because your creature's going to die no matter what. But by you casting Stomp there, you effectively stomped their Bone Crusher Giant. Granted, they don't have to spend the mana on it, but you still cut off that as a play for them to make. And that's the best you can do in that situation. So adventures are a big one that they need to resolve in order for them to get the creature at the end. But this comes up with other things as well. And be on the lookout for times when your opponent's spell resolving is better for them than you using a removal spell on your own creature. And against creatureless decks, you know, your eliminate's just not going to do anything anyway. So you might as well use it to deny them a card.
Yeah, that's a really good example, because obviously in the mono red matchup, you know that you probably have things in their deck that you kill with Stomp, but if they didn't play anything in the first two turns of the game that could be stomped, it makes it a lot less likely that they have one in their draw. And so now we've sort of shifted our baseline understanding was Stomp is going to be able to kill something this game too. And maybe they haven't drawn anything that Stomp is going to be able to kill. So now I'm starting to get into like, well, maybe the value of Stomp isn't that high. And so that's a great example of how you can take the advantage of knowing, of seeing what's going on in the first couple turns of the game, updating your model in your head of what plausibly could be in their hand, and reevaluating how good your cards are as a result.
All right, you're selling past the close. I think we already convinced people to stomp their own stuff in response to Stomp.
Well, you shouldn't always do it, but if they played a bunch of... whatever. I'm not getting into this with you. I'm not doing it. Not doing it.
All right. Let's talk about keeping one-landers. It's a topic near and dear to my heart. So the conventional wisdom is definitely that you should mulligan one-landers, but you should keep a pretty high percentage. In fact, I believe your roommate stated 30%.
I think he was more talking about limited, but yes, he did say that.
I think in general, one-landers are more keepable than you might think. And here's the factors that go into keeping one-landers. One, being on the draw. Big part of it, because you get that extra draw step to find your second land. The other is, what does your hand do with a second land? If it's basically a perfect hand, you're playing mono-white, and your hand is a plains, 2 1-drops, 3 2-drops, and then like a Skyclave Apparition or something, that hand goes a long way with one land, and once it gets its second land, it can cast basically everything. That's a much more appealing hand than you're like, well, I've got one land and a Heartless Act, but then I have a Cultivate on 3. Like, that's not really going to cut it. You shouldn't be keeping those kinds of hands. So basically, it's what can I do if I don't draw a land? And does my hand basically work if I draw exactly one land? Am I on the draw? And then also, to some degree, what am I playing? What is my opponent playing? How much latitude do I have there?
Yeah, obviously, when you have a one-lander, you know, we're talking about more along the lines of the actual one-landers. Like, there's virtual one-landers. You know, one-landers where you have something like Attune with Aether or a similar land-searching effect that can actually just immediately get you a second land in hand. I don't really consider that a one-lander. I mean, it is in the sense that technically only one card is type land, but the reality is that you're going to have a second land in hand deterministically almost immediately. But the situations where, you know, you're potentially on the draw with a bunch of cheap cards which allow you to catch up in the game, where you're not particularly concerned about your ability to be able to play something like a 3-drop on time or be able to cast a card in your hand on time. I would say in general, the biggest thing that you're going to care about is how well you spent your mana in the first 4 turns of the game. Doesn't matter that you're going to have spent a lot less than you typically can do. And if you say, no, you know what, it's fine, I don't mind it, I have Red Cap Melee in my hand, it's generally not going to be that important that I can actually cast this card on time. It's more just like, do I eventually get to cast it at some point this game? These are all sorts of factors which are going to be increasing the likelihood that you want to keep a one-lander.
How often do you think you keep one-landers, like at end of the day?
I mean, I don't know, like 5% of the time. It's maybe even less than that. A lot has to be going right, but it's sort of one of those things where the cost of mulliganing is quite high in Magic, even in the Age of London mulligan and all that. And so when you mulligan erroneously, you are oftentimes it's one of the most impactful decisions you can ever make in a match. And so that's why part of the reason why we're talking about it is, though, even though I'm guessing, Luis, you don't do this very often either, is that when it does come up, it really can be the difference between you winning or losing a match.
Yeah, I would guess, especially since I play a lot of limited, it's more than 5% of the time that I keep one landers, but it's not like a ton more. And we've talked at length about how the mulligan system especially favors being more aggressive with mulligans these days. So that certainly leans towards not keeping. But yeah, it's a high leverage decision. And this is one of those things where it comes up infrequently, but it does matter when it comes up where you should be keeping that one lander instead of mulliganing it. And hopefully we can encourage you to keep slightly more one landers than you would otherwise.
All right, next up. Let's talk about situations where you're just not going to play your cards. And so what we're talking about here is you have this two drop in your hand. Maybe it's something like a Robber of the Rich. And you just decide, you know what? I'm just not going to play it here. I just think that the game it's going to go better for me if I just refuse to play it on this turn because my opponent just had this weird pause maybe during my upkeep. And I just know they have the stomp. They have no other card that would give them this like, that would cause them to pause or have a stop or whatever. And as a result, I just, you know, I have like a Fervent Champion on turn one maybe. And so it's like, oh, okay. They have something they could plausibly kill, but I don't want it to be the high value one. And my hand is set up in such a way where I think I might be able to legitimately in the future get better use of it. And so this is sort of a basic example of a situation where maybe you want to consider just not using your ban on anything and just refusing to play your cards in a curve that makes normal sense.
Bone Crusher Giant is definitely a big reason not to do this, but even to expand it past that, sometimes you're in a situation where your opponent's got a removal spell, you're pretty sure about that, maybe multiple, and you could play a creature, but all that would let them do is kill it, and there's a couple reasons not to do that. One is, can you use your mana in some other way, whether that's like play an instant or put something on the board that maybe doesn't do much right now, but could pay dividends in the future, like you know, example, like maybe playing like a mana rock or something instead of playing a creature. The other is they don't have anything to do with their mana. So kind of an old strategy used to be where against a deck that has a bunch of counter spells and factor fictions, the four mana, like draw a bunch of cards card, you don't play anything on turns 2 and 3 when they have counter spells up. And then on turn 4+, then you start deploying your threats. And the reason is, if you play a threat on 2 and they counter it, and then you play a threat on 3 and they counter it, and then you run out of threats, they'll just cast a factor fiction on turn 4 or 5. But if you wait a few turns, they can't use their mana on turns 2 and 3 very effectively. But on turn 4, they're really itching to cast that factor fiction. And knowing what's in the other deck and knowing, well, on turns like 2 and 3, they don't really have a good mana sink, but on turn 4, they can start playing Eureka Moment. A lot of the Sol to Ultimatum decks are playing that now. You can maybe choke them on mana where you don't play anything that they can respond to until after the point where they can actually use their mana. Another time is, you know, this comes up sometimes, your opponent's going to discard to hand size and they're playing a deck with a bunch of removal or counter spells. Sometimes it's better just to play your land, say go, and let nature take its course. They miss their fifth land drop and have to discard. Whereas if you'd played a card, all you would have done is let them kill your card effectively for free.
Do you remember that match I won with, was it blue-black control with Sultai on Ultimatum like a couple weeks ago?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay. This was I played this game where it was just I couldn't believe it. It didn't seem possible that I could win. It was game one where I was playing Ultimatum and Historic versus blue black control, and they just were loaded up on counter spells in hand, and I just got to a spot where I basically had one more big card in hand, but it was so obvious they had a counter spell that I just basically sat on it until I could get to a spot in the game where I could play two of them in the same turn. And then I caught them in a window where they weren't prepared to answer to be able to play two cards in the same turn because they had tapped lower than they should have. And I was able to sneak out the game. But it was a spot where it took a lot basically because I thought it was so unlikely that I could possibly win the game through the one counter spell that they had to have. It just didn't seem like it was plausible they didn't have that. I basically took a chance and it actually paid off for me down the line. And I would say this comes up against counterspell decks is that sometimes is that you need to find tricky sequences where you ultimately are setting it up so that you can do multiple big things in a turn. It's a tactic we've talked about against control decks and put your opponent in a spot where if they get complacent, they tap down too low, that you can then, you know, sort of immediately punish them by doing having a haymaker turn out of nowhere that they didn't see coming because you just spent so many turns passing. This is the kind of thing you generally don't want to do because essentially what you're doing is you are making such a hard read on what the state of the game is. And the idea of like a hard read is one is that you're basically not saying like, oh, I think your hand is, you might have this, you might have that. You're basically with this line, you're saying, I know your hand has the answer to this card and such, I'm not going to play this card, which would help me out a lot if it resolved. And by making such a hard read, you sometimes will be able to set it up so that a couple turns down the road, you might be in a more advantageous spot where you've either drawn other cards that can protect it or accompany it well to maybe, you know, maybe you draw the discard effect a couple of turns from now. And all of these sorts of things can sometimes add up to you stealing games and matches that you really have no business winning. But you have to be very high confidence because we've, Luis, you and I have been in many spots where our opponents, we've been playing late in a tournament, like a Grand Prix, for instance. Our opponent maybe wasn't particularly accustomed to playing late in day two. And I think you and I both have pretty good like in game faces at the table, not in the sense that we're trying to menace our opponents, but like we both look like we're pretty into the game. And I know I've heard this from people, and it's like people do not want to just make a huge blunder against us. And sometimes it will cause them to make a huge blunder against us.
I think, you know, the classic example is you've got a handful of garbage, but your opponent just doesn't want to believe that or can't believe that. And they just don't go for it. They play scared. And yeah, there was an old name for that with Finkel, the Finkel fear factor, where people just played like garbage against John Finkel because he was Finkel. Of course he had it. And paradoxically, or maybe whatever, it just means that he does always have it because you play like that and then he'll have it more often because you give him extra time to draw into it. And I think that the way modern Magic works right now, you should basically play your most expensive spell most turns of the game because those are the best cards and you're not really getting punished for doing that. But there are definitely situations where you just don't play anything and that's the right play and that will also throw your opponent off. It's the funny thing is it actually kind of it really trades on the fact that it is the right play to play your most expensive spell most of the time. So if you don't do that, you're sending a pretty strong signal that you don't have the card they're worried about, but instead you have something else. And the place they go to often is like, oh, they must have like a counter spell or something like that.
Yeah. And in the case of what happened in my game was I didn't play anything for a couple of turns, and then I played an Alrun's Epiphany, and it seemed so much like bait, but it really wasn't. The Alrun's Epiphany then resolves, and then later, a turn or two later, they played a Narset, and then my birds were just able to get the Narset off the board, and they had so many counterspells I later saw in their hand that game. It just, none of this should have happened, but it just did, because I just basically played the game patient, refused to just run my stuff out as fast as possible. This stuff is all really hard to figure out how to do, and so we're not generally advising you want to like just refuse to play your cards like you mentioned. It's generally just better to play the game normal. But, you know, when you get into a spot, particularly the spot I would encourage you to experiment more is when you get into a bad matchup, a matchup that you know is really bad, and figuring out how to play creatively, how to play differently, how to throw your opponent off the rhythm. You know, these are all sorts of the classic, like, underdog Rocky type of things where, you know, Rocky box left-handed and that really threw off Clubber Lang is because, or Apollo Creed, rather, just because, you know, that wasn't the kind of thing that he was used to. He was used to the game going in a certain direction, and sometimes just the act of taking the game down a path they're not ready for will just throw them off of their game in a really profound way.
Well, also, I mean, as we know, the listeners of Constructed Resources have kind of mastered conventional wisdom, and we're here trying to provide them that little extra edge they need to get over the top. And, you know, all the strategies we talked about today are things you mostly shouldn't do, but when you should do them, they can actually help you win games you wouldn't otherwise be able to win. It's really important to be able to kind of figure out, like, where are places I can pick up extra wins from? Because everyone gets like a good 50% of wins, right? Like it's just not that hard to win half your matches if you come with a good deck and you're reasonably prepared. Every win above that you have to work for. And some of these wins are only accessible to you if you do stuff like keep a one lander or just refuse to play your four drop on turn four or, you know, end up killing your own creature in response to a Brazen Borrower. And the more of these tools you have in your arsenal, the more often you'll pick up those somewhat marginal wins. So definitely a lot of good stuff here. And we certainly encourage you to kind of experiment with the stuff, but be aware also that sometimes misapplying this can be dangerous. But I always think of it as a learning pursuit. Losing games in practice or playing on the ladder or whatever it is that's like not the highest of stakes is often worth it, and in fact, often better. When you make a mistake in practice, you're way less likely to make that mistake in the at the time that it matters. When you realize all of a sudden, like, whoa, that card doesn't target, or oh, that thing has reach, or whatever it is that you got taught, you will really remember that a lot better if you end up making that mistake and losing as a result. You just hope that that loss comes in practice and not in the Mythic Invitational qualifier when you're playing to make day two or what have you. All right, that will do it for this week. Little advanced plays for advanced players, as it were. Hope you enjoyed this episode of Constructed Resources. You can find me at LSV on Twitter, and you can find BK at ABEX or in your nearest Battlegrounds lobby, depending on what time of day you're at. We will see you next week, and remember to keep these plays in mind when the situation comes up.
All right, Luis, I want to talk about the NFT stuff, and not because it's like I want to, expose us to getting canceled or anything like that, which would be fun, but not going for that today. No, I just thought I'd throw out some thoughts that I've had just from following all of the discussion. So for those of you who haven't been following, basically there was a interview the other day with the CEO of Hasbro where he got asked about NFTs, and he basically said that, it's a big opportunity for us and it's something that they're looking into. And it really spooked a lot of people who have strong feelings about it. So NFTs are non-fungible tokens, and they're basically a type of technology that uses blockchain protocols to basically form a decentralized way of verifying a digital object, and that that the person who owns it actually does own it. And so it's been used to recently in things like, the NBA has a NFT marketplace, NBA Top Shot, where people can basically own highlights. And it sounds kind of ridiculous, but it's basically the idea is that what it is that it allows people to do things like have a system of collectibles for digital objects, much like we have, sports cards and, the classic Magic the Gathering is a collectible card game. It allows people to essentially own digital objects. It's come under a lot of controversy because there's been all sorts of issues with it, from one, whether or not the artists who originally owned the work are always getting properly compensated. In some of these blockchain systems, once somebody has basically minted the NFT, it can be very difficult to actually prove that it was inappropriate that it was minted and that the original artist did not receive proper credit or compensation for it. There's also issues with cryptocurrencies. Cryptocurrencies are a common application of blockchain technology. Like Bitcoin is the most famous example of that. But what's going on here is that with certain blockchain technologies like Bitcoin and Ethereum, they have profound environmental impacts because they use what's called a proof of work verification, where they're actually, your computer's doing a tremendous amount of computing power, taking them out of computing resources from around the world to necessarily validate that you are the person who did the work to own this digital object. And so, for instance, Bitcoin, that means they've been mining prime numbers, or they've been proving the discovery of prime numbers and to acquire new Bitcoins. And the whole thing is crazy complicated, and I'm not trying to go too deep on any of it, but I just want to try to actually lay it out. If you're somebody who maybe has sort of seen these hot takes but doesn't understand what's going on, but basically, this has caused real issues in the world. Like, there's a semiconductor shortage going on in the world right now. There's a tremendous amount of electricity and fossil fuel resources that are being dedicated towards the computing power to generate new Bitcoins. And some of these technologies that are powering NFTs, most of them, I believe, run on Ethereum, have some amount of environmental impact associated with them. And so it very much concerns people that at a time when, we're dealing with climate change and all of the things that we need to do as a species to be able to protect ourselves and our planet, that we're now inventing new ways to basically prove that somebody owns a digital version of the Mona Lisa instead of trying to actually solve the problem of climate change. And so in that respect, I totally get why people are having a huge issue with NFTs, because it doesn't seem like it is inherently true that the technology needs to use computing resources on the scale that it's using now, and that future iterations and improvements in the technology will allow it to be run in a way where there isn't a considerable environmental impact. That isn't where we're at today. And so what is the point of investing in this kind of thing right now if the environmental impact is still potentially severe? And so, at the same time, I do think people are being a little bit hyperbolic with some of the statements that they're making. Obviously, if you've lived in the world for the last 10 years, you understand that you mostly don't want to get into a discussion about the intricacies and nuances of how Bitcoin and other blockchain technologies work, just because it's likely to get you into a discussion with somebody who knows more about it with you and has a very zealous stance on the matter and is going to take you down a rabbit hole you don't want to go down. But anyway, my basic take on this is that I get where people are coming from, and I think that I hope that people can express their views in a way where they don't feel like they need to make stuff up. I think the biggest thing you can do when you find yourself in a situation like this is express the concerns you have. But I've seen a lot of what I would describe as people making up things. Like I've tried to lay out my understanding of the situation, and I'm guessing I've said a couple of things that are wrong here just factually about what my concerns are, but I have tried not to stretch too far beyond what I actually know. And I hope that maintains some credibility with all of you in terms of what my viewpoint is on this. And that's the biggest thing I can hope, is that when you deal with people on the internet, if you want to get their attention, you want to just say things in the most ridiculous way possible. But if you're somebody who enjoys playing Magic and growing in this community, be aware that whenever you open your mouth, there's likely 10 times the number of people, if not more, who are watching what you're saying but aren't actually going to respond to what you're saying. And they're going to judge you for the way that you conduct yourself. And you don't get that many points with people. You don't convince that many people by overstating your knowledge and overstating things in a way that isn't accurate. And you're likely, if anything, to some degree, to push people away from you if you just say things that are out and out wrong, because it makes it, you know, if somebody needs to lie or make something up to convince you of their position, it makes their position just sound weaker. So that's all I know about the situation. I get why people are upset. It's really messed up that we're destroying the planet and that our world leaders don't seem to be giving it the seriousness, and we are having trouble getting the political pressure to take the maybe what are the necessary steps to doing this. And I totally get if you're pissed off that we're now coming up with new technologies that are allowing us to burn more resources, even if the things that we're talking about aren't necessarily on the scale of some of the things that are actually contributing to climate change. But it's just, you know, it's a little bit of a straw that broke the camel's back. And so hopefully, if you're somebody who's super into cryptocurrency and you don't understand why people are frustrated by this, well, that maybe gives you a better understanding why. And if you're somebody who doesn't like it because you just don't like the way that people talk about Bitcoin and that kind of stuff, well, maybe I hopefully have explained things in a way that gives you a little bit more knowledge about the situation.